The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So, welcome everyone. I'm not going to waste much time before jumping into the topic tonight because we have a lot to cover. I'm going to be speaking about the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is translated as the Great Passing Away, or the Discourse on the Final Nirvana, or the Great Final Extinction. And this sutta is the story of the Buddha's last days on earth and of his final release from the cycle of suffering and the round of rebirth. It might be a slightly different style of Dharma talk because it really tells a story, and it's historical, and it's really rooted in early Buddhism. And I'm going to talk I'll define a few terms before we jump into it, just to provide some clarity. The sutta gives instructions to the followers of the Buddha to continue to follow what he taught after he's gone. It also provides a beautiful example of how a human being can go through the process of illness and aging and death with great freedom and peace. And every person, every teacher that teaches on the sutta will do so in a unique way based on their experiences and personality. And I'm just going to mention that I will be including some of my experiences working with patients that are dying, because I think that is as much a part of my Dharma practice as formal meditation. So it's a very practical approach to kind of understanding the sutta. There are some other versions that are very scholarly or more mythological, but I'll focus kind of more on some of the practicalities tonight. Couple of facts about the sutta that some of you may be interested in. This is actually the longest sutta in the Sutta Pitaka, which is the collection of around 10,000 discourses given by the Buddha and his disciples. It's part of the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses. And it has a narrative structure. So Ajahn Brahmali, when he was talking about this sutta, said it's not really a sutta at all, because typically a sutta includes a particular teaching, for example, the Four Noble Truths. But this sutta includes biographical material about the Buddha and is spoken through the voice of a narrator, not only the voice of the Buddha. And it is said that in some traditions, the sutta is actually part of the Vinaya, which is the kind of code for the monks to live by based on how the Buddha lived. A couple of words that are important to know, especially if you're new to Buddhism and new to Common Ground. There's this word Tathagata, and this is the word that the Buddha uses to refer to himself. So he does not use the pronouns I, me, or myself. He says the Tathagata. This translates as one who has thus gone or one who has thus come. And it kind of refers to a being that is beyond duality, is beyond coming and going, and is kind of beyond the vicissitudes of the human realm. Some words used to describe Tathagata are immeasurable, hard to fathom, and not apprehended. Another word that many of you will be familiar with is Mara. Mara is the kind of mythological personification of greed, anger, and delusion, what we call the defilements, the things that obscure our minds and lead to suffering. In this tradition, there's sort of this character named Mara that represents these things. And he's sometimes referred to as the Buddha's tempter or the evil one. And he attempts throughout the Buddha's life to prevent his awakening and then to prevent him from teaching. He makes a cameo appearance in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So the other word is Nibbana or Nirvana or Nibbana, which translates as to blow out or to extinguish as with a flame. And in Buddhism, it refers to the cessation of suffering and of rebirth. And there's actually two types of Nibbana. There's Sopadisa Nibbana, which is Nibbana with life remaining. So it's a person who has awakened, is enlightened, but still has life to live and may still have karma to ripen. And then Parinibbana means Nibbana without a remainder. So this is the final or the highest kind of release. And it happens at the time of death. So that brings us to the title of the sutta, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So it's the great passing away into final Nibbana, which is what the Buddha does. It was really interesting. I was looking up other talks on this topic just to see what was out there. And there are 38,300 talks on Dharma Seed right now, and I was able to find 7 that mentioned either Mahaparinibbana, last days of the Buddha, or last sermon. So it's not, in my experience, commonly taught in the West. There are some talks primarily by monastics on YouTube, including an 18-hour lecture series by Ajahn Brahmali, if you're interested in digging deeper. But additionally, I looked up Maranasati, or mindfulness of death, and I only found 100 talks. And then when I searched death and dying, I found about 700 total of 38,000 talks, which I thought was a small number, given how much the Buddha spoke about mindfulness of death and contemplations on death as conducive to awakening. So I'm happy to add Dharma Talk number 8 to Dharma Seed on this topic tonight. It is different than Maranasati. We're not doing mindfulness of death with this. And it's different than the Tibetan teachings on kind of the transference of consciousness and bardo states and all of that, as described in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So those are different topics. We're going to talk about the Buddha's last days tonight. Okay, so this sutta is divided into 6 sections. I might refer to them as sections or kind of chapters. And the first section is called In Magadha. So Magadha is one of the great kingdoms in ancient India, and it's in the region of the present-day Bihar state in the northeastern part of India, next to Nepal. And the story opens with the king of Magadha wanting to wage war on a group of people called the Vajis. He says he wants to annihilate them, to utterly destroy them. But before he does this, he decides to seek counsel from the Buddha because he knows that the Buddha is very wise and can likely provide some good advice. So he asks his chief minister to go to the Buddha to pay homage to him and to ask him for his advice. And the Buddha responds by asking Ananda, who's a very important character. Ananda is the Buddha's cousin and his personal attendant. He asks Ananda about the behavior and the integrity of the Vajji people. He goes through a whole list that includes, you know, do they act ethically? Do they respect their elders? Do they respect some of the traditions, et cetera, et cetera? And he says, if they do these things, if they're acting with integrity, with ethical conduct, then their growth is to be expected and not their decline. And the chief minister of the king of Magadha hears this and he understands what the Buddha is saying. He says, No harm indeed can come to the Vajis in battle by Magadha's king, except through treachery or discord. And with this, he takes leave of the Buddha. So he understands that there's some kind of force or sort of protective energy about the Vajis in this story that comes from their integrity, their ethical conduct, their sila. And so this is sort of a story that leads to what the Buddha is going to teach his followers. After this story is shared, the Buddha speaks to the community of monks, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and later to the lay people. And he says that the most important things for you are to cultivate ethical conduct and mindfulness, loving kindness, concentration, and wisdom. And if you do these things, your community will grow. Your growth will be expected, not your decline. So he's thinking about his absence and kind of what will lead to the continuation of these teachings and to this community. And he says the foundation for passing on these teachings is ethical conduct, is mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. And for the lay people, the householders, so all of us who are not monastics, he describes five perils and five blessings of the life of a householder. The perils stem from heedlessness, which I think of as kind of lack of mindfulness, not paying attention, not being sensitive to cause and effect. And he says, heedlessness leads to a loss of wealth, a poor reputation, a timid and troubled demeanor, death in bewilderment, and rebirth in a realm of misery and unhappy state. On the other hand, the five blessings accrue to a righteous man or woman, through the practice of virtue. And these include great increase of wealth through diligence, a favorable reputation, a confident deportment, and a serene death. Also rebirth in a happy state in a heavenly world. So this is just the first section of a very long sutta, but I think it kind of sets the stage in terms of the Buddha's emphasis on sila, on ethical conduct, and on integrity for living a life that is free from suffering and for having a peaceful death, and for those who believe in the process of rebirth, for having rebirth in a happy state or a better state. And I was thinking about this. I've kind of reflected on each one of these sections of the sutta in the context of the work that I do with people who are dying or very sick. And there are many ways, I think, that people who've lived a life of integrity and who have practiced ethical conduct, never perfectly, but who've tried, seem to have more peace at the end of their lives. And I think one of the reasons is what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. So not having regrets, not having kind of, in Buddhism, we talk more about wholesome regrets, hiriyotapa, but not having that weighing on your mind when you're sick and when you're nearing the end of your life. Also, the beautiful benefits that come from wholesome relationships, from treating other people with kindness, from telling the truth. All of these things, when we practice them throughout our lives, I think as the Buddha tells us here, and as I've seen in real life, I think they can help us to experience the process of dying with a heart that is much freer than if we don't practice them. So in some ways, this first part of the sutta isn't completely related to all of the rest of the events that happen, but I think it's really important and something that we may not think about as a cause for happiness in our kind of fast-paced culture, but which really is important, which is our sila, our ethical conduct. The only other thing I'll say about this first part is that we're introduced to some of the supernatural abilities of the Buddha that continue to show up throughout the rest of the sutta. And these include his ability to see into the realm of deities, divine beings, with what is referred to as his heavenly eye, to make predictions about the future. And at one point, he somewhat miraculously transports his body across the flooded Ganges River. So kind of seeing these abilities in the context of his human life is a theme throughout the sutta. So the second section is called Journey to Vaishali or Vaishali, which is another ancient city in present-day Bihar, India. This section opens with a teaching on the Four Noble Truths by the Buddha to a group of monks. He then discusses the four stages of awakening, which are basically descriptions of the progressive kind of refinement of the heart and mind. And throughout the first part of this section, the Buddha continues to encourage the development of virtue, sila, concentration, and wisdom. And he reminds the monks that there are great gains and great fruits for those who practice them. Towards the end of the section, the Buddha is invited to a meal by a courtesan named Ambapali. And there's a conflict after Ambapali asked the Buddha to dinner because another group of people called the Luchavis wanted to do the same. And the Buddha accepts Ambapali's invitation because that was offered first. And he tells the Luchavis that he's not going to be able to come to their meal. And there's quite a bit of arguing and harsh speech that the Luchavis give to Ambapali. But the next day, the Buddha takes his bowl and his robe and he goes together with a community of bhikkhus to Ambapali's land. And they're served a meal. And she actually gives the Buddha the land that they're sitting on as an offering. And this is another story in kind of this introductory part of the sutta where you wonder kind of, okay, like, why is that in there? You know, like, I bet he had a lot of meals and a lot of, you know, gifts offered to him. But I think what it highlights is just the practice of generosity, of dana. And this is one of the paramis or one of the qualities of the awakened heart. And it's something that I think is emphasized less in Buddhism as practiced in America. I lived in Thailand for a couple of years, and I always felt like generosity was foundational to their spiritual practice. And I felt it, and I received so much. And I think I can see why it's, you know, emphasized here and in the sutta, because it really is an important practice, I think, on the spiritual path. So the most important part of this section is when the Buddha becomes sick for the first time. This happens at the beginning of the rains retreat. And I'm going to read an excerpt from the sutta describing this experience. When the Blessed One had entered upon the rainy season, there arose in him a severe illness, a sharp, And sharp and deadly pains came upon him. And the Blessed One endured them mindfully, clearly comprehending and unperturbed. Then it occurred to the Blessed One, it would not be fitting if I came to my final passing away without addressing those who attended on me, without taking leave of the community of bhikkhus. Then let me suppress this illness by strength of will, resolve to maintain the life process and live on. And the Blessed One suppressed the illness by strength of will, resolved to maintain the life process, and lived on. So it came about that the Blessed One's illness was allayed. This passage demonstrates a few things, one of which is the Buddha's ability to be free from suffering despite physical illness that includes sharp and deadly pains. The second is the thoughtfulness that he shows in wanting to make sure that he takes proper leave of the community of bhikkhus. In modern day palliative care practice, we would call this advanced care planning, where we think about, you know, what are the important things that you need to do before you go? You know, let's make sure that happens. Kind of thinking about other people in his life and making sure that they're okay. And the third thing is this power of mind that he demonstrates, and kind of power of will to influence these energies of life in order to stay alive longer. So the Buddha recovers from this first illness, and his attendant, Ananda, expresses overwhelming joy and relief. Ananda says, when I saw the Blessed One's sickness, it was as if my own body became weak. Everything around became dim to me, and my senses failed me. And Ananda goes on to say that he was hoping that the Buddha would not pass away until he'd given them some last instructions. And the Buddha responds, somewhat surprisingly, by saying, Ananda, what else do you expect from me? I've taught you everything you need to know, and I haven't held anything back from you. And he says, now I am frail, Ananda, old, aged, far gone in years. This is my 80th year, and my life is spent. Even as an old cart, Ananda, is held together with much difficulty, so the body of the Tathagata is kept going only with supports. He then goes on to explain that it's only when he's in meditation, deep states of meditation, that he's able to feel more comfort in his body. And this section closes with a very famous line from the Buddha, where he says, therefore, Ananda, be islands unto yourselves, refuges unto yourselves, seeking no external refuge with the Dhamma, the truth of the way things are, as your island, the Dhamma as your refuge, seeking no other refuge. So I was thinking about this second section, and the theme that came up for me was letting go. I think with the story of Ambapali that opens this section, we are taught about letting go through the act of generosity, through giving and thinking about other people. And during the Buddha's sickness, we're taught about letting go of our attachment to the body and to health and to kind of youth. And lastly, with the body's, with the Buddha's response to Ananda, I think the Buddha's trying to teach Ananda to begin to let go of his attachment to him, his beloved teacher. And so when he says, be islands unto yourselves, he's saying, if you want to be fully free, we have to begin to learn to let go in all of these different ways. There's a lot that I could say about this theme of letting go from my work in palliative care and hospice. But there's two patients that come to mind that I took care of within the last few months that really taught me a lot about letting go. And one of them was a young woman with cancer in her 20s, and she was dying, and she was at the kind of end of further treatment options, and she had come into the hospital with an infection. And she made the very courageous decision, with the support of her family, to enroll in hospice and to go home and to die at home. And I just remember being in her room and feeling an incredible sense of lightness and peace. And she was a spiritual person, she was a religious person, and I think that helped her a great deal. But I just remember her family would just wave us in from the hallway, the palliative care team, because they would say, "Oh, are you the team that's going to protect her from like going on a ventilator and having all these interventions?" And I had never seen a patient that young with that much grace and acceptance and willingness to trust the process and to let go. And it's a patient I will always remember. A couple of months later, I had a patient who was elderly, kind of, I think mid-80s, and she had been diagnosed with acute leukemia, which the prognosis is typically days to weeks or potentially months, but probably weeks with no treatment. And I went to talk to her about hospice and about, kind of transitioning to more of a comfort-focused approach. And her loving family was in the room, her son and daughter-in-law. And the patient was really not interested in talking about hospice or talking about end of life. And the patient's daughter-in-law was reflecting and saying, "You've lived such a wonderful life. You have all these blessings. You have grandkids, you know." And the patient just responded and said, "It's not enough." And we just like my team have continued to kind of like think about this case as, you can have all of these beautiful things, and you can have a belief that it's not enough, and you can suffer immensely because of that. And so, two hugely different cases, 60 plus years apart in age, and completely different ways of relating to death and dying that came from the heart, that came from their mind, that came from their choices. And so I think, in the second section of the sutta, this kind of introduction to letting go, which some would say this whole path is about, but clearly a very important thing. So we're on to section 3 of 6. And this section is called Relinquishing the Will to Live. I was thinking of this section as the completion section. And in order to understand it fully, we have to first review some information about the Buddha's life and his decision to teach in the first place. Many of you are familiar with the story of how the Buddha decided to teach. But for those who are not, I'll share a couple of excerpts from another sutta. It's the Ayacana Sutta, The Request. So shortly after the Buddha became enlightened, he was sitting under a banyan tree, and it is said that the thought came to him, "This Dhamma that I have attained is deep, hard to see, hard to realize, peaceful, refined, beyond the scope of conjecture, subtle, to be experienced by the observant. But this generation delights in attachment, is excited by attachment, enjoys attachment. For a generation delighting in attachment, excited by attachment, enjoying attachment, this, that conditionality and dependent co-arising to teachings within Buddhism are hard to see. This state, too, is hard to see. The pacification of all fabrications, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, unbinding. And if I were to teach the Dhamma, And if others would not understand me, that would be tiresome for me, troublesome for me. As the Blessed One reflected thus, his mind inclined to dwelling at ease, not to teaching the Dhamma. So after the Buddha became enlightened, he did not want to teach. He thought, oh my goodness, this is going to be really tough. These humans have a lot of greed and anger and delusion, and I'm not really interested in it. So he decided not to teach. But there was a Brahma, so a divine being, who became aware of this situation. And he said, the world is lost. The world is destroyed. The mind of the Tathagata, the Arahant, the rightly self-awakened one, inclines to dwelling at ease, not to teaching the Dhamma. So he goes to the Buddha and he pleads with the Buddha, will you please teach the Dhamma? There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are falling away because they do not hear the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. And the Buddha, after hearing this Brahma's invitation, it is said, out of compassion for beings, decides to teach. And he says, after he tells his decision to this Brahma, open are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears show their conviction. So this is about 45 years before the current sutta, where the Buddha's at the end of his life. And in that interim period of time, he has taught hundreds and thousands of people. I just think it's really interesting to think about the fact that he hadn't initially wanted to teach, and that all of these teachings came from this place of compassion and wanting to help people see. So now we come back to section 3 of this, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Two important things happen in this section. First is that the Buddha has a conversation with Mara. Mara is, as I described before, this mythological personification of greed, anger, and delusion. In this section, Mara comes to the Buddha and says, now, let the Blessed One come to his final passing away. Let the happy one utterly pass away. The time has come for the Parinibbana of the Lord. For the Blessed One spoke these words to me. Years and years and years ago, the Buddha said this to Mara. I shall not come to my final passing away, evil one, until my bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen, have come to be true disciples. Wise, well-disciplined, apt and learned, preservers of the Dhamma, living according to the Dhamma, abiding by appropriate conduct and having learned the Master's word, able to expound it, preach it, proclaim it, establish it, reveal it, explain it in detail, and make it clear. Until when adverse opinions arise, they shall be able to refute them thoroughly and well, and to preach this convincing and liberating Dhamma. So he told Mara, I'm not going anywhere until I have finished this task that I've set out to do. And so when I read this section, I think about this care and compassion that the Buddha had for his students, for the monks, and the commitment that he had to stay with them until he was sure that they understood. And just thinking about, you know, if he had either not decided to teach or not decided to follow all the way through with this, that it's possible we may not be here tonight learning these teachings, practicing this path. I also think it's really important to recognize the relationship that the Buddha continues to have with Mara throughout his life. We often think, you know, I want to push Mara away. I want to push my greed, anger, delusion away. But those who have practiced, especially doing retreats and just paying close attention to the defilements, you realize that wanting them to go away and to push them away is not actually the cause. for the defilements to attenuate. We have to accept that they're present and to understand them and to relate to them with wisdom. And so throughout the Buddha's life, Mara is present, but the Buddha is not confused by Mara. And in this instance, he stands by what he had said before and says, you know, I'm not going to leave until I've completed my teaching. So, but in this case, actually, the Buddha says, do not trouble yourself, evil one. Before long, the parinibbana of the Tathagata will come about. 3 months hence, the Tathagata will utterly pass away. So this is the first time that the Buddha announces his parinibbana. Notice he doesn't use the word death. He uses the word parinibbana. So the final extinguishment of suffering. And after this announcement, there is a great earthquake. And Ananda, in amazement, asks the Buddha, what could possibly have caused this earthquake? And the Buddha goes on to explain 8 causes of earthquakes, one of which is the moment when the Tathagata renounces his will or relinquishes his will to live on. This section ends with Ananda's appeal and what is referred to as the last admonition. So after the Buddha announces his parinibbana, Ananda is very distressed, and he asks the Buddha to stay for a longer period of time for the welfare and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world. And the Buddha says, Ananda, don't you remember? I told you many times that beings who develop what's called the Iddhipada, I don't want to get too much into this, but certain powers of concentration and kind of development of the mind, if they so choose, they can stay to the end of one world period, which in the translations amounts to kind of the full lifespan, the full maximum lifespan of a human being for that time period. And the Buddha says, I talked to you about this, Ananda, many times, and you never asked me to stay. So the fault is yours, Ananda. Herein you have failed. And I think about that statement and how Ananda must have felt in that moment, feeling responsible for the Buddha not staying longer than the 3 months that he's announced. And this part of the story, it was hard for me to understand at first, but as I was reflecting on it more and more, I was thinking a lot about relationships, and especially the teacher-student relationship, but also other relationships. And it feels like in this case, this story emphasizes communication and, you know, giving people a reason to be in your life or to live for something. And it's probably more complicated than that. But I think there is this poignancy in the fact that the Buddha tells Ananda, well, if you had asked me, I may not have said yes the first time or the second time, but if you'd asked me a third time, I would have stayed for you, Ananda. And Ananda never asked. And the second part of the sutta that I mentioned, or the second part of this section of the sutta, is the Buddha's kind of final admonition. And it's a very, very well-known line, and it's going to come up in the very end of the sutta. The Buddha says, all compounded things are subject to vanish. Strive with earnestness. The time of the Tathagata's parinibbana is near. 3 months hence, the Tathagata will utterly pass away. So I've heard this line many, many times, and I'm sure many of you who've kind of practiced meditation and been part of Buddhist communities have heard it as well. And I think in some ways it can be a little bit confusing or almost kind of harsh and stoic, like just let go of the world, don't be attached to anything, be tough, sit still, don't cry. But I think that, and I have learned that an important part of this ability to let go, or this process of letting go of attachment to form and feeling and perception and mental formation, all of the what's referred to as the khandhas, is actually learning how to trust and to feel safe in the space that remains when we let go of these things. And in Buddhism, this kind of space of non-attachment is referred to as emptiness. In other traditions, it might be referred to like the eternal or theistic tradition, kind of God or divine presence. And I think that sometimes our fears about letting go or relinquishment relate to not knowing what we're letting go into. Kind of what is that space? What are we left with? At the retreat that I did recently at Prairie Farm, we were talking about how there's this kind of fear of annihilation and fear of boredom and fear of sitting in that space. So I think when the Buddha says all compounded things are subject to vanish, strive with earnestness, he is telling us that we have to be mindful, we have to be aware that the things of this world are not going to last forever and they can't be a permanent refuge for us. But also to remember that the path leads to peace and this feeling of trust and this feeling of ease. And it's something that we can't necessarily imagine or kind of cognize before we experience it. I'll talk a little bit more about this at the end. So there's a three more sections, and these will be a little bit shorter than the first three. Like I said, this is potentially 18 hours of material in 45 minutes. So the fourth section is called the last meal. At the beginning of the section, the Buddha is invited to a meal by Kunda, a metal worker. And the following day, he goes with his community of monks to Kunda's house. Kunda prepares a special meal. It's called Sukara Mandava. And the commentaries are not entirely clear on what that actually is. But the most important thing to note here is that the Buddha tells Kunda to serve the Sukara Mandava only to him, not to his monks, and to bury the remainder in a pit, because he cannot see anyone in the entire world that would be able to eat it and to fully digest it except for himself. Soon after the Buddha finishes this meal prepared by Kunda, it is said that a dire sickness fell upon him, and he suffered sharp and deadly pains. But again, he endured them mindfully, clearly comprehending and unperturbed. And again, just thinking about how, despite this physical discomfort, the Buddha was able to bear it with mindfulness and with wisdom. And this is a bit of a side note, but it is said that the reason the Buddha experienced this kind of dysentery-like illness was that in a previous life, he had been a physician and there had been some sort of conflict with his patient or the patient's family, and he intentionally gave this patient laxatives and caused diarrhea. And so, as the story and mythology goes, this was the ripening of the Buddha's karma leading to this illness. So after this, the Buddha tells Ananda that he would like to go to another city. And on the way there is this beautiful moment of just the Buddha's humanity as they're walking down the highway. The Buddha stops at the foot of a tree and he tells Ananda, "Please fold my upper robe in four, Ananda, and lay it down. I am weary and I want to rest a while." And I think this is just a really beautiful moment of kind of self-compassion on the part of the Buddha and recognizing the limitations of his body and the physical form that he's living in, and taking care of it. And the Buddha then asks for water, and Ananda tells him, but the water in this area is not good. You shouldn't drink it. It's not clear. And the Buddha says, Ananda, go get me some water. And when Ananda goes, he finds the water to be perfectly clear and pure. And he says, marvelous, most wonderful indeed is the power and glory of the Tathagata. And then there's a conversation with another person about deep states of concentration and some of the benefits of those. And after this, he asks this individual to bring him some new robes. And the Buddha puts these robes on, and Ananda comments on how incredibly clear and radiant the skin of the Buddha becomes. And the Buddha responds saying, there are two occasions, Ananda, when the skin of the Buddha becomes exceedingly clear and radiant. Which are these two? And he says they are the night that the Tathagata becomes fully enlightened and the night when the Tathagata comes to his final passing away. The section ends with the Buddha telling Ananda to make sure that Kunda does not feel bad about the meal that he served him. He tells Ananda to tell Kunda that actually it's an incredibly meritorious action to serve the last meal of the Buddha's life. So make sure that Kunda does not feel remorse for this. And I'm going to skip one part for the sake of time, and we're going to move on to sections 5 and 6. So section 5 is called At Kusinara, and I've kind of thought about it as final instructions. So at this point, the Buddha and Ananda and all of the monks make their way to the Sala Grove of the Malas. And the Buddha asks Ananda to prepare a couch for him between two Sala trees. And he says, I'm weary, Ananda, and I want to lie down. And the Buddha lies down, and it is said that when the Buddha lied down, the Sala trees broke out in full bloom, even though it was not the season of flowering. And the blossoms rained upon the body of the Tathagata and dropped and scattered and were strewn upon it. And celestial Mandarava flowers and heavenly sandalwood powder from the sky rained down upon the body of the Tathagata. And the sound of heavenly voices and heavenly instruments made music in the air out of reverence for the Tathagata. And the Buddha says to Ananda, you know, Ananda, these flowers are nice. This music is nice. It's all really great. But the best way to honor and respect and to venerate the Tathagata is for you to practice the Dhamma. That is more beautiful than all of the heavenly voices and the flowers and all of this beauty. And he's kind of asking them to practice, saying that it's the best and the kind of the highest way that they can honor him. And then one of my favorite sections in this entire sutta comes next, when Ananda begins to express his concerns and his grief over the loss of the Buddha. I'm going to just read a section called Ananda's Grief. Then the Venerable Ananda went into the Vihara and leaned against the doorpost and wept. I am still but a learner and still have to strive for my own perfection. But alas, my master, who was so compassionate towards me, is about to pass away. And the Blessed One spoke to the bhikkhus, saying, where bhikkhus is Ananda? The Venerable Ananda has gone into the Vihara, and there stands leaning against the doorpost and weeping. Then the Blessed One asked a certain bhikkhu to bring the Venerable Ananda to him, saying, go, bhikkhu, and say to Ananda, friend Ananda, the Master calls you. And that bhikkhu went and spoke to the Venerable Ananda and brought him to the Blessed One. Then the Blessed One spoke to Ananda, saying, enough, Ananda, do not grieve, do not lament, for have I not taught from the very beginning that with all that is dear and beloved, there must be change, separation, and severance? Of that which is born, come into being, compounded, and subject to decay, How can one say, may it not come to dissolution? There can be no such state of things. And he goes on to tell Ananda that he has attended to him with so much loving kindness and so much care over the years. And he goes on to praise him and express his gratitude for him. And I just envision this moment as such a tender and caring interaction between Ananda and the Buddha, almost like a loving parent who is dying and wants to impart wisdom and love to their child. And it reminds me of some of the things that we tell our patients and families to say to each other as they're dying or as they're approaching the end of their life. Some of you may have heard this before, but what we tell people is to say, thank you, I love you, I forgive you, please forgive me, goodbye. So the Buddha is not only affirming the teachings and telling Ananda, you know, this is the way, but he's saying, and thank you, Ananda, for everything you've done for me and for your kindness. And he praises these kind of superlative qualities of Ananda to all of the other monks. So the last part of this section is the final disciple of the Buddha, Subhata. He comes and he asks for teachings, and Ananda initially refuses him and says the Buddha is too sick, he's ill, he's too tired, he cannot teach. And the Buddha overhears him and says, no, Ananda, let him come. What he asks me will lead to his benefit, and he will be able to understand. And so the Buddha teaches Subhata, and he asks for admission to the order to ordain, and Subhata ordains. And then as these stories go, he becomes enlightened shortly thereafter. And then the last section of the sutta is called The Passing Away. And it opens with the Buddha saying to the community of bhikkhus, I know you might be thinking that after I'm gone, there will be no teacher and that these teachings will not be here for you. But that's not correct. The Dhamma, which is always present, and the discipline that I've given you will be your master when the Tathagata is gone. They will guide you. So he's just saying, like, I know I won't be here in physical form, but I've given you the Dharma. I've given you the discipline. And he asks this community of 500 monks if there is anyone who has any remaining doubts or perplexities as to what he has taught. He asks them three times, and there is complete silence. And he says, I knew there weren't going to be any questions because I know everyone here has at least reached the point of being a stream enterer. That is, they are kind of well on their way to enlightenment. And then the Buddha gives his final words, which we've already talked about. All compounded things are subject to vanish. Strive with earnestness. And I decided to create a revised version of these words as well that I think can be a little bit more accessible. And I think about this as I could see Mark maybe saying something along these lines. It's kind of like wisdom infused with a lot of loving kindness. So these are my revised last words of the Buddha. Dear ones, all of the things of this world, your body, your thoughts, your feelings, your favorite possessions, are not permanent and will never lead you to true lasting happiness and freedom. I care about you and I want you to be free and to know peace. So I encourage you to follow this path with energy and faith and perseverance and love so that in this life and in your death, your heart and mind and body can be deeply at ease. After this, the Buddha enters a state of meditation, and he transcends all of the jhanas, these states of concentration. The first, the second, the third, the fourth, he goes through what are called formless jhanas, comes back down to the first jhana. Then he goes back up to the fourth jhana, which is kind of described as this a place of perfect equanimity. And it is said that he immediately passed away from the fourth jhana. After this, there was, of course, a great earthquake, and many beings, including some of the monks, wept and flung themselves on the ground in grief, lamenting that the Buddha came to this parinibbana too soon. And then some of the other monks, who seemed to have understood what the Buddha was teaching, observe them and just gently remind them about the Buddha's words on not being attached to form and the things of this world. So the section ends by describing a number of celebrations. Many people come to honor the Buddha's remain. It is said that the whole of Kusinara, where he died, became covered knee-deep in Mandarava flowers. And eventually, one more disciple, Mahakasapa, arrives and pays his respects to the body of the Buddha. It is burned, and there are no ashes or particles that remain, only bones. And it is said in the sutta that water rained down from the heaven and extinguished the pyre of the Blessed One. The last part of the sutta describes the partition of the relics. They go to different groups of people who promise to build stupas and to hold festivals in their honor. And I'm just going to read the last several lines of the sutta, which it is said were actually added later by some monastics from what is now Sri Lanka. Eight portions there were of the relics of him, the all-seeing one, the greatest of men. Seven in Jambudipa are honored, and one in Ramagama by kings of the Naga race. One tooth is honored in the Tavatimsa heaven, one in the realm of Kalinga, and one by the Naga kings. Through their brightness, this bountiful earth with his most excellent gifts is endowed, for thus the relics of the all-seeing one are best honored by those who are worthy of honor, by gods and Nagas and lords of men, by the highest of mankind. Pay homage with clasped hands, for hard indeed it is, through hundreds of ages, to meet with an all-enlightened one. So that was a lot of information, and I hope it just encouraged some interest in this sutta. It was very much the highlights. But I think it's really beautiful to hear about this part of the Buddha's life and kind of the narrative and the humanity of the Buddha and his experience with a body that is sick and aching and dying. I am more than happy to answer questions. I also know that we're approaching time. And so what I might just do is have invite Mary to do the announcements, and then I'm happy to stick around for anybody that wants to ask a question.
I just recently turned 80, and I'm thinking a lot about the five reflections. I say them as frequently as I can, and so thank you for sharing your version of it as well. I think I struggle with, I really want my passage into death to be a lot more peaceful than I think my mind is now, you know, in my current life here now. And I struggle with that a lot because I really want to be at peace with myself now and also when I'm preparing to die. And it's just a struggle for me because of ongoing issues that I struggle with. I think I'm too caught up in my trying to solve present problems by myself and not letting go, which you refer to quite often. So, but thank you for the teaching. I don't know that I have a question there, unless you find one that you might want to respond to.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing. I think, you know, the Buddha provides this beautiful example, and it's a lot easier, you know, said than done to go through some of these processes and, you know, being sick and getting older. And I think each person kind of finds what practices are most nourishing and soothing for them. And I think Yeah, I just encourage you to kind of explore what feels healing for this heart here and now. One practice that I personally have found taken a lot of refuge in, and I appreciate what the Buddha said about the benefits of at the time of dying, is loving kindness. The Buddha said that those who practice loving kindness will die unconfused. And I've said to Mark before that that is enough for me to dedicate my life to loving kindness, because I've seen so much suffering and confusion among people who are dying. And so that feels really inspiring to me, and it may or may not be helpful to you.
Thank you. That's excellent. Actually, today I had a medical appointment, and on my way there, a man was coming out who had no legs. And I was walking, and I turned around and I said to him, "Can I help you in any way?" And he said, no, he was okay. I just dwelt on that for so long. What is it like to, how is he going to get into his vehicle and drive away and all that? But it was, he was okay, he said. And I suppose that he probably was, because he's learned how to live with that. But it struck me so strongly that, you know, I should offer help. I'm headed in the right direction. I just need to believe in myself more, I think. Thank you.
You have it in you. We all do.
Thank you.
Roseanne.
There was just one statement that I wasn't sure I heard properly. And it was after you talked about, when you were talking about, and thank you very much, by the way, for this excellent evening. It's been wonderful. But at the Buddha's deathbed, when he was expressing what the reaction, the most skillful reaction is when you are with someone who's dying. And I think it had to do with just practicing the Dharma, but you used some words that I may not have heard. And could you just go over that again about how we act at the bedside? What is our reaction at experiencing someone else's death?
Yeah, so he doesn't specifically talk about that. He did say that kind of as he's lying on his deathbed, you know, it's not the flowers and the music and these kind of sense experiences that I value the most. I value the most your practice of the Dharma. And I think, you know, just speaking from my own experiences and the teachings that I've learned over the years, I think being present, kind of in your body, in the moment, with someone who's dying is really powerful, with an open heart, kind of going back to the meditation at the beginning, allowing everything to belong, and not pushing anything out of your heart in those moments. It's really challenging. But I think that is really kind of abiding in the present moment with mindfulness. And then the words, you know, things that I've said to patients. Well, there's two different things. So we tell patients and families to say to each other, if it feels appropriate, "Thank you, I love you, I forgive you, please forgive me, goodbye." But if you're with someone who's dying, especially in kind of that very end stages when maybe they're not even conscious and you're not really sure what to do, I will often say, I'll tell them where they are. So I'll say, you know, "You're in the hospital, you are safe, we're taking care of you, you're doing everything right, you're not alone." So like, those are some words that I say to people who are dying.
Thank you. I think the word I missed that I hadn't heard was just the word practice. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was so simple that I thought, oh, I must have misheard. the way to respond, our proper response is simply, with all the other things you just suggested, but simply to practice.
Yeah, exactly.
If we think it's simple.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, this is Holly, and I just want to say my heart is just full of so much gratitude for this talk. So thank you. Thank you so much. It's really meaningful to me. I lost a lot of people in the last few years and was at people's side when they were dying. And so this is just really, really very special. Thank you.
I might mention for those who've stayed on, if you're interested in this topic, there's a course that I'm actually taking right now, and it's really excellent on embodied philosophy that is focused more on the Tibetan Book of the Dead by Andrew Holacek. And he also wrote a book called Preparing to Die. He's just incredibly bright and thoughtful and has worked with these teachings for many, many years. There's also a really good book. I haven't read it yet, but Ajahn Analeo, it's, I think, mindfulness with like aging, illness, and death. Something like that, but it's supposed to be a very good book. Any other questions?
I was just going to say, yeah, for me, it's, and probably for so many of us, it's just the attachment to all the wonderful beauty of life and having to say goodbye to it. I mean, I found myself getting choked up reading Harry Belafonte's obituary today. It's like, oh, and just thinking about all the things that are changing in the world that aren't the same as they have been. And just, yeah, having to let go, that profound, profound having to let go.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we still can celebrate the beauty and the joy and the love. And we do that in the context of knowing that there's an even higher, greater, more stable happiness available. So the Buddha taught us to celebrate the joy of others, to respond with compassion and love, and also to kind of understand the way everything works, and let go into the highest happiness, which is peace.
The most helpful thing I've heard, Mingo Rinpoche was talking about how often people, their inability to let go is their concern for their loved ones, that this, you know, that's so difficult because there's so much concern for the people that that love them. And Mingo Rinpoche's teaching around that, he said, you know, especially for Buddhists, is to remember the myriad compassionate beings in this realm, and for him and for some Buddhists in others, but all of these compassionate beings, and as an act of faith, to trust that those compassionate beings will be there for your loved ones, and that that you can sort of turn your own compassion and love over to the other compassionate beings. And I just thought that was such a beautiful teaching, because in my experience, that's, there often is, not at the very end, but sort of in the weeks leading up to it, a lot of suffering around concern for other people. And I just found that a very wise and helpful teaching.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I was talking to my friend Samuel the other night about kind of the dead relative sign that I see with my patients, which is very real. And it is when patients are visited by deceased relatives, before they die, and it's almost always within a few days, like 1 to 3 days of their death. But there's something that, you know, you have to be a kind of open to that, but I, based on how much I see it, I kind of am. But there's something that's really beautiful about it. You know, a lot of the times it's like really soothing and comforting for the patient.
This is really good, this teaching. I really appreciate it. And it made me cry, and I never cry, hardly ever, ever. And it's really healing for me, because when, you know, when nobody is dying, nobody wants to talk about death and be reminded of the pain of death and how difficult it can be and the loss and things. And then when people are dying, we're so unprepared because we never got to talk about it. So it's really good to just open up about it and let it come out. And I really want to thank you.
I'm happy for the opportunity and happy to do more on this topic. I think this could have probably been like four lecture or four Dharma talks over time.
You just have to come back.
Yeah.
I have one question. Last person standing at the city center. Thanks for your talk tonight. I was very grateful I could help host on this side of things for you. I have, hopefully I'm not keeping you too late, but I have in the, has it's fairly recently, last couple years, had two family members who passed like pretty unexpectedly. You know, like no one really expected it, and they were not prepared at all. So this is different end of the spectrum than we've been talking about a little bit. And I think I'm just wondering if there's like anything for, you know, for the remaining members, like if you have anything from the context of the practice that I could think about. I think I've got to the point where it's just like acceptance. There's not anything I can do about the situation and how they went and how they were prepared. But I think sometimes it still is like there's a slight unease about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think two things come to mind. I think in the Tibetan tradition, there's some even more kind of nuanced, like actual practices for kind of post-death, kind of sending merit and good wishes to the deceased. But I think, you know, something that I've done with family members that have died, I know you're not technically, I think, supposed to send metta to someone who's deceased, but to just, you know, bringing their memory to your mind and heart, and kind of like we did in this practice tonight, just holding it with care and just seeing what comes up for you. And I imagine, you know, a lot of things will, especially if it was a sudden death. But just practicing kind of sitting with that, with their memory, with their presence, and with gratitude for the good parts of your relationship, the beauty that they brought to the world, and a willingness to feel any sadness that comes up and to let it move. The other practical thing that I recommend to my patients, family members, people who have had a loss, is that the relationship never ends. It doesn't have to end. And you can figure out ways to continue it, whether that's through writing, you know, writing them a letter, journaling, doing an activity that they loved, like carrying something on that they started, recognizing how they show up in you as a person. So just kind of recognizing that continuity, that connectedness that is always there.
Hi, Meg, this is Adam. I want to thank you for your talk tonight. So much to think about. One thing that rises to the top for me is the grasping that I have done, and I've witnessed others too, of holding on to loved ones who are in the process of dying, and wondering how we may keep them around, maybe past their comfort level. Where, you know, part of our practice is to let go. So I'm just holding that and thinking about that. But I'm fascinated about, you spoke about the Buddha's skin, and I've witnessed in witnessing elders pass in hospice, how the skin changes, especially in the last couple hours, and wondering if there's any teachings on what transmission actually happens for, perhaps not the Buddha, but folks like ourselves in that last handful of hours. I wonder if you can speak to that.
Yeah, so I'm still a student of this. This would be kind of more spoken to in that Tibetan tradition and in the course that I mentioned. But, you know, there's these external signs of dying, which are pretty well characterized. You know, this is what we teach medical students and residents. Patients begin to become more sleepy, lose consciousness, obviously stop eating and drinking. There's changes in breathing. You can have irregular breathing, raspy, kind of rattled breathing. The pulses change. People can get modeling of the skin. Temperature changes. And in the kind of Tibetan Buddhist, Ayurvedic yoga traditions, this all corresponds to kind of the dissolution of each of the elements. So earth, water, fire, air, space. So there's kind of the external signs. And then it's said there's kind of these internal processes of consciousness kind of moving and then eventually transitioning through these bardos that happen after death. And I'm not quite ready to teach on that topic, but yeah, there are these obvious signs. I think that radiance, I've seen that too with some people, kind of like that young woman I talked about who was just so at peace and so wise, like beyond her years, she had this like lightness and radiance about her. And so I think it does maybe reflect one's spirit and one's kind of clarity. The other thing I'll just follow up is we have so many family meetings in the hospital where we have to gently redirect the family who is often making decisions because someone doesn't have the ability anymore. Gently redirect the family to what would the patient want, not what do you want. you know, if the patient could be here with us today, what do you think they would say? And sometimes when we do that reframing, the family's like, oh my gosh, they wouldn't want to be kept alive like this. And they realize that like we were doing this for us. And so encouraging families to give their loved one permission to die and to let go can be important.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.